This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Now. Now your ideas don't have to wait. Now they have everything they need to come to life. Dell Technologies and Intel are creating technology that loves ideas, loves expanding your business, evolving your passions. We push what technology can do, so great ideas can happen right now. Find out how to bring your ideas to life at Dell.com. Welcome to Now.
Every now and then, the economy hands you a big giant pile of, it's fine. Today, it turns out, was one of those days. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is the 6th of May today, Friday. Glad you're here, as always, everybody. The big, giant pile of, it's fine, economic number of the day today is 160,000. That is the number of people who got new jobs last month. Sudeep Reddy's had his job for a while. He's at the Wall Street Journal. Neil Richardson is at Redfin. They are both in our studios in Washington. The topic, of course, is the 5 days gone by. Hey, everybody.
Hey, Kai.
Hi, Kai.
So, yeah, I mean, I'm right, Sudeep. You've been there for a while, right?
I have been here for a while. That's a very great intro.
So, let's do jobs first, and then we'll move on to some other stuff. Give me, find me the silver lining, please, in this report.
The silver lining is that it's along the same trend that we've seen for a while. We did see job growth slow a bit if you look at the raw numbers, but if you realize the statistical noise around these figures, it was a single month's job number is not all that meaningful in a labor force of 159 million people, and we're basically on the same track for job growth. I'm a little concerned that the silver lining that we saw was that wage growth was 2.5%, which is we've been here before, and we haven't stayed around that level for very long before. So we are coming up to the 7th anniversary of this economic expansion.
I know, it's crazy, right?
And thought it was really a good sign that we saw 2.5% wage growth, and that's probably not a great sign.
As the president said today at his press conference, it's been 74 months and 14.5 million new jobs. Neela, I think Sudeep stole your silver lining, right?
Yeah, he often does that. But, you know, if you pair that with two kind of interesting pieces of data and research, one, that layoffs are on the rise, and two, that the economy is creating a lot of temporary and contract jobs, what you see, what the upshot is that, you know, the economy is creating more jobs, but they're riskier. And that does not translate into good consumer spending. So still some stuff to worry about.
And, you know, consumer spending upon which the economy rests. Sudeep, give me a very quick drive-by of Janet Yellen's brain right now.
Janet Yellen is looking at the world around her well beyond the job numbers. Lots of uncertainty around the world, political risk, the likes of which you have not seen before in several economies around the world, and turned up a notch in our own over the last week or so. Yeah. So she's got to think about all of that and not just what happened with the payroll report.
Neela, thoughts on Dr. Yellen or no? And no is a perfectly acceptable answer.
You know what? I'm thinking she's thinking, thank goodness it's Friday.
As are we all. All right. I want to turn actually to the thing that Sudeep was alluding to, the politics of the American economy today. Donald Trump went on CNBC yesterday, and they were having a conversation about U.S. debt, as Mr. Trump likes to do. And he was asked about some comments he's made in the past talking about renegotiating American debt. That is U.S. Treasury bonds, federal debt, and the whole full faith and credit thing. Here is what he said in response to that question.
I've borrowed knowing that you can pay back with discounts, and I've done very well with debt. Now, of course, I was swashbuckling, and it did well for me, and it was good for me and all that. And you know, debt was sort of always interesting to me. Now, we're in a different situation with the country, but I would borrow knowing that if the economy crashed, you could make a deal.
Sudeep, let's set aside for just a second the swashbuckling thing and talk about making a deal that is giving U.S. bondholders, holders of U.S. Treasury debt, haircuts basically on their holdings. Make that make sense for me.
This discussion feels like it's a bizarre dream that we're supposed to wake up from at some point. I cannot wrap my head around what kind of president thinks this way about an economic crash and thinks it is a good idea to predict what you would do in an economic crash. And the prediction is that you would renegotiate the one financial security that is considered the financial security that is safest around the world. It is the underpinning of the global financial system. It is the underpinning of the global economy. And you don't just renegotiate it and think that you're going to come out of it on come out the other side in a better position. It just doesn't work that way. This is not a hotel or a casino. That's not how it operates. So it's a little concerning that we're still discussing things this way.
Neil, if you were a bond trader, would you answer the phone when Mr. Trump calls to renegotiate?
No, I wouldn't. Fiscal debt and corporate debt are two entirely different things. And you swashbuckling strategies in corporate on the corporate side may pay off, but on the fiscal side, it leads to financial ruin. And I'm surprised anyone would want to negotiate from a position of weakness, which is what this would lead to. It would lead to higher interest rates and increase the cost of our debt payments, increase the cost of consumer spending on houses and cars. It would really lead to a lot of catastrophic financial events. And so as a creditor, I would say no to that deal.
Neela Richardson at Redfin, Sudeep Reddy at the Wall Street Journal. Thanks a lot, you two.
Thanks, Kai.
Thank you, Kai.
All right. Have a nice weekend, I guess it is, right? Not just a day. Wall Street Today also, interestingly, just fine. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Let's spend another couple of minutes on jobs, because there is something that Neela and Sudeep and I didn't get to. The question of what kind of job growth the economy is going to be able to produce, given that economic growth is also fine. And that's kind of being kind. From our desk at Oregon Public Broadcasting, Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman is on that one.
Several analysts greeted the mediocre jobs figures with, yeah, we saw that one coming.
Generally, the rate of jobs gains is starting too slow.
Bill Northey is chief investment officer at U.S. Bank Wealth Management, and he says recent turmoil in global markets and turbulence in domestic politics have really cramped robust growth and job creation. Plus, he says as the unemployment rate falls, it actually becomes more difficult for employers to hire the qualified workers they need.
And as you get closer and closer to full employment, it's going to be hard to sustain that level of job creation.
Karen Mills ran the Small Business Administration. She's now at Harvard, and she pays special attention to the struggles of small business owners.
They were so hard hit that they still are a little bit cautious whether or not the future is going to be bright enough to invest in new people.
And she says recently their confidence level has fallen. There is a more optimistic view out there that April's lousy job numbers could be an anomaly, a seasonal variation. That's economist Aparna Matter's view at the American Enterprise Institute.
To me, 160,000 sounds really low, and I'm hoping it's a blip. We will get the GDP growth, and we will get strong hiring.
And she sees hopeful signs in today's jobs report as more of the long-term unemployed and part-time workers who want full-time work finally find the jobs they've been looking for. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
The 142nd running of the Kentucky Derby is tomorrow, which means oceans of mint juleps are already filling glasses and sterling silver cups at parties around Louisville. More will flow tomorrow as fans around the world celebrate and pick their horses. American whiskeys, including the bourbon, rye, and Tennessee varieties, are hot right now, both here and abroad. And we are shamelessly grabbing onto the Derby as an excuse to look at why that is happening. Marketplace's Mark Garrison called up a bar in Scotland for this story on an American whiskey with deep ties to a Kentucky horse race.
It's just after 5 on Friday night at Chenaskies in Glasgow, and the bar is packed. But in the native land of Scotch, this bar focuses on other whiskeys.
I really like High West Campfire. I really like Durnheim.
That's Joanna Crawford, bar manager. All the whiskeys she's excited about are made in the USA. Scottish brogues singing praises of American whiskey is a historic shift. Until fairly recently, American whiskey was a sleepy category, but it has exploded around the world as young drinkers dial back on beer and move away from vodka cocktails. Phil Lynch is VP of Jack Daniel's maker Brown-Forman.
So the millennial generation has decided that they want something that they can actually taste.
He spoke from Churchill Downs, of course, where his bourbon Woodford Reserve is a sponsor. Whiskey makers have increasingly gone upscale, using packaging and marketing that emphasizes quality, drawing global big spenders of all ages. Distilled Spirits Council data show distillers selling nearly $2.9 billion in American whiskey in the U.S. last year, a 52% jump from 2010. In the same period, exports grew 33%. That's not just good for companies distilling the corn and rye, says Tom Perko of drinks consultancy Bevmark.
Those who are raising the corn, people blowing the bottles, and the people driving the trucks.
But back in Scotland, our bourbon-loving bar manager is seeing signs of trouble.
The price has gone up quite a bit, I've noticed, in the last couple of years.
Just like everything made in America, a strong dollar can make it tougher to do business abroad, even for an intoxicating product. I'm Mark Garrison for Marketplace.
The conventional wisdom story coming out of San Francisco the past, decade maybe, has been all about tech and the boom, all sunshine and light. But you read beyond those stories, and there are things happening that aren't so good. Lousy traffic is one, the high cost of housing is another. Worse, though, homelessness, which has dogged San Francisco for decades. The city, though, does have a new plan. Sam Harnett has the story.
So that's a bed and then and a couch.
Reina Nonag is showing me her new home. It's the first one she's had in a long time.
My closet you don't want to look at because it's so messy.
It's a small room at the Henry, an old single-room occupancy hotel that's in a rough patch near downtown. The city is leasing it to house the homeless. Nonag has been without a place to call home for 6 years. Near the end, she was being physically abused by a man she thought was her friend. She had to get off the street.
That's it. I was, like, determined because I was tired. You know, like, this foot said, I'm tired. This one said, me too. You know, so it was like, I'm sorry to get sent to the bus. It's just a blessing, you know, that I did this far.
Nona got the room by going to the Navigation Center. It's a new shelter where the homeless can stay for a few months at a time and receive personalized attention. It's a centralized gateway to take people in, stabilize them, and put them on a path to housing. This, believe it or not, didn't exist before, says Sam Dodge.
We're struggling, clearly, on the street with so much inflow, so many people becoming homeless.
Dodge is the city's homeless czar. He says, like many cities, San Francisco didn't used to have a very coordinated approach to homelessness. He says the Navigation Center has been revolutionary. Other cities are now coming to San Francisco to see how it works. And really, Dodge says, it's kind of a no-brainer.
You go and you look at it, and it's like, oh, there's nothing magic about this. It's just a place. We have many cities have other assets that they could, you know, repurpose for this. It's the idea that's important, not the building.
San Francisco is doubling down on the idea, or rather tripling. It's planning two more Navigation Centers. But then there's this other problem. How do you house the people coming out of the shelter? That is where the hotels come in. The city is taking out multi-year leases on places like the Henry. Dodge says the city is committing $3 million a year to add 200 more rooms.
This is a way to really tell a story about how we can use supportive housing to solve the homeless crisis.
Dodge says it's not a quick fix. The city will have to continue assisting these new residents for years. There are on-site case managers to provide support and counseling. Loretta Olivencia directs all the services at the Henry, and she says new tenants have lots of questions.
You know, what do we do now? Now that we're here, like, where do we go? We've been on the streets for this long, and we've pretty much been fending for ourselves, so where do we go now to get food?
There are many barriers to self-sufficiency. Residents come in with trauma and substance abuse problems. They aren't used to managing money, finding steady work, or even furnishing their new place. To help new tenants like Reina Nonag get started, the Navigation Center sends them off with some practical items.
Center, they give you like a whole, what do you call that, housewarming package. And so they gave me this toaster oven, this nice soup pot, rice cooker.
For the first time in 6 years, Nonag has a safe place for her stuff. She lost most of her possessions living on the street, but not her little sound system and CDs. She tells me she likes Beethoven and Al Green. It's amazing, Nonag says. In her new home, she can put on an album whenever she wants.
I'm so tired of being alone. I'm so tired of on my own. Won't you help me, girl, just as soon as you can?
In San Francisco, I'm Sam Harnett for Marketplace.
Coming up, he would just think he had discovered a technology that was going to change the world, and it never did.
There's a reason Mark Twain is remembered for his books and not his financial smarts, you know. But first, yeah, okay, sure. Let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's up 79 points today, 0.4%, 17,740. The NASDAQ up 19 points, about 0.4%, 4736. The S&P 500 up 6 points, a 3rd percent, 2,057. For the 5 days gone by, the Dow down 0.2%, the NASDAQ off 0.8%, the S&P 500 down 0.4%. The payment processing company Square charged down 21.2% today, reported a bigger-than-expected quarterly loss and said expenses rose sharply. The company is founded and run by Jack Dorsey, the same guy who co-founded Twitter, by the way. Energy stocks revived after crude oil top 44 a barrel. ExxonMobil gushed up about 0.5%. Bonds fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note up to 1.77%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. I'm going to mix up my network slogans here, but this Sunday night is going to be some must-see TV. I'll tell you what. Game of Thrones, yes, but that's cable, so it doesn't really count. After 7 seasons on CBS, The Good Wife is coming to an end. The saga of Alicia and Peter Florrick came right at that moment in time when the business of network television ran smack into the growing expectations of television viewers. Marketplace's Adrian Hill is on that one.
We first met Alicia Florrick back in 2009. On stage, cameras clicking, she was standing stoically by her man, who'd been caught up in a sex scandal.
Good morning. An hour ago, I resigned as state's attorney of Cook County.
It's a show that is in many ways a hybrid of network drama styles. Part legal procedural, part serialized soap, but that could hold its own as good cable.
It was a kind of a pretty sophisticated show on a number of levels.
Michael Curtin is a professor of media studies at the University of California, Santa Barbara.
It had very sophisticated actors. It had very sophisticated writing. It had a very alert and deft sense of the law.
The show didn't rely on scandal-like over-the-top plots, and when it did kill someone off, it caused a national outcry.
The Good Wife's stunning shocker.
All good for viewers, but one of The Good Wife's most impressive accomplishments, meeting the demands of the network business model, 22 episodes a year.
You're really dealing with a moment there where, from a business perspective, networks weren't comfortable going under 22 episodes.
Miles McNutt is an assistant professor of communication at Old Dominion University.
And this was because to make their money back, eventually they want to get into syndication.
For that, you needed about 90 episodes. Today, cable and streaming services have taken over the prestige drama, Game of Thrones, House of Cards, but they don't work at anything close to a network pace. Deborah Birnbaum is executive editor of television at Variety.
I think it is a challenge to deliver this kind of storytelling on the 22-episode basis.
And she says the broadcast networks have started to figure this out.
Probably what we'll see is more business models on broadcast television looking to do 13-episode storytelling.
Easier on the storytellers, easier on the actors, and for all of us, easier to binge on the weekend. I'm Adrian Hill for Marketplace.
When the Republican Party rolls into Cleveland, Ohio this summer for its convention, the city is going to put its best foot forward. The downtown business district is getting an overhaul. Everything is going to look and feel great. But there is a part of Cleveland that delegates probably aren't going to see because the grittiest neighborhoods in town aren't getting any touch up at all. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Genza reports.
Downtown Cleveland is one big construction site right now as the city gets spruced up for the Republican convention. Stroll through the Central Business District and you'll see new hotels being built and office buildings getting facelifts. It's loud. But head over to the northeast side of town, the inner city, and the sounds are different. This is Jeff Johnson's turf.
Councilman for the city of Cleveland, Ward 10.
And we're in your ward right now, Ward 10. And we're sitting in Johnson's ward office in a big meeting room where he's held a number of question and answer sessions for constituents about the convention. He supports it, by the way, and voted for some preliminary convention funding. Still, he and his constituents aren't sure what's in it for them. They ask him,
are we losing our police officers that patrol our neighborhoods because they're going to be dealing with issues associated with the convention?
Johnson says officers in his ward already have plenty of issues to deal with. He says a third of his constituents live below the poverty line. There's gun violence. And the neighborhood is still struggling with foreclosures from the housing crisis.
And as you drive through it, you'll see some abandoned buildings right next to a full-blown working business.
I see what Johnson means after we leave the ward office.
So we're going to go down one of the main corridors of the northeast part of the city of Cleveland.
Uh-huh.
And we're going to go to Angela's Neighborhood Restaurant.
Okay. All right. As we drive down the main corridor, I see the abandoned houses Johnson talked about. We pass by that fire engine you heard earlier. There are lots of fires here in those abandoned buildings. We head into the diner, and Johnson brings me over to a table where Bill and Hazel Dale are sitting. They tell me they're afraid their neighborhood will be isolated during the convention.
Everybody gonna be downtown, you know, I mean, they're not coming to the inner city.
And then, too, it's amazing how they could find so much money to put into downtown. And it's like, oh my goodness, if you can find money for down there, then you need to find money for the neighborhoods.
Johnson is trying to steer some of the convention spoils to his neighborhoods. Later, at a city council meeting with Republican National Committee representatives, he tries to get his local vendors on the list of businesses selling supplies to convention organizers.
And I just want to reiterate the subject of supplier diversity, the need for this city's citizens to somehow have a benefit.
We use union labor.
That's Jeff Larson, the CEO for the 2016 Republican National Convention. He says they're working on diversity with a local host committee. The committee says it's reaching out to minority-owned businesses. It's hired Cleveland State University to do a study on the economic impact of the convention.
Our overall tax base will be a little bit higher due to this event.
That's Irene Lendl. She's interim director of the university's Center for Economic Development. She says the city will collect more in sales and room taxes during the convention.
And the larger budget will allow larger investments in more disadvantaged areas as well.
Jeff Johnson, the city councilman, says his neighborhoods will get some of that tax money. It'll go into the city's general fund. But Johnson estimates Cleveland will only get about a quarter of the money spent at the convention. The rest, he says, will go to the private sector, mostly the downtown businesses that are getting spruced up. In Cleveland, I'm Nancy Marshall Genzer for Marketplace.
Mark Twain is remembered as one of the great American writers. What he was not, a fact that's not often taught to sixth graders studying Tom Sawyer or Huck Finn, was a very good businessman. Twain lost thousands, millions in today's dollars on failed investments and plain old bad judgment. But the idea he came up with to revive his fortunes, literally, basically changed comedy as we know it. Richard Zaks tells the tale in his book, Chasing the Last Laugh.
Mark Twain was one of the greatest American authors ever, with a phenomenal once-a-lifetime sense of humor. He wrote Adventures of Tom Sawyer and of Huckleberry Finn. He got his start writing these very funny travel books. But Mark Twain was also an investor, and that's what led to his downfall. He lost money on pretty much anything he touched. Magnetic telegraph, steam pulley, an engraving process, the Fredonia Watch Company. He had moonshot enthusiasm. He would just think he had discovered a technology that was going to change the world, and it never did. So Mark Twain finds himself deep in debt. He's 60 years old. And his books are not selling. His backlist is kind of tired. And the only way he can make money fast is to basically go on the platform and tell jokes and tell stories. Mark Twain in the 1890s decided that he needed to find as big an audience as possible. And he always thought really big. So he went to Australia, New Zealand, India, and South Africa. And it was very unusual for a performer to do that. He's charging a dollar a head, which was then a day's wage for somebody back then. So he's charging a day's wage to see him perform. His irreverence and his wit wound up making him a fortune. The idea that he got in that scrape, we all get in deep debt sometimes, and that he climbed out, and he climbed out by basically talking his way around the world. He said he talked his way out of hell, and he did.
Richard Zacks, the author of Chasing the Last Laugh, talking about Mark Twain. This final note on the way out today, I'm pretty sure this is the marker for peak online food delivery services. The New York Times is getting into the game. Yes, that New York Times. Actually, what you get is just the ingredients from recipes pulled from the NYT cooking site, which is pretty good, truth be told. It's that whole we'll send you the ingredients, you cook thing. Also, you could just do takeout. Hi, Kai Rizdahl here. Thanks so much for listening to Marketplace. You hear me do the numbers every day, but we aim to bring you more than the numbers. We give you the context you need to understand what's happening in the economy and why it matters to you. We'd like you to help keep our numbers strong by making a tax-deductible gift to Marketplace. And this month, your gift in any amount is going to be automatically doubled thanks to a dollar-for-dollar match from Newman's Own Foundation. So please donate today at marketplace.org. All right, Friday, we're out of here. The Dow up 79 points today, 0.4%. The NASDAQ up 19 points, 0.4% there as well. The S&P 500 picked up 6 points, about 0.3%. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Sitar Nieves. Deborah Clark is the vice president and executive producer. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you on Monday, everybody. Have yourselves a great weekend, all right? This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.